Good morning. This is the K-Boo Morning News. Friday. I'm Jake Wallner.
And I'm Chris Andre.
Coming up, former Portland Airport screeners won their claim that they were not given the chance to retain their jobs after they were federalized in 2001. National Intelligence Director John Negroponte says that nearly 100,000 Americans are working for the agency within the U.S. and around the world. In Iraq, Shiite politicians are divided over who should replace Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari. Portland area weather today, cloudy, rain this morning, clearing in the afternoon, highs around 60.
A federal jury has awarded nearly $665,000 to 22 former Portland International Airport screeners who said they were not given a fair chance to retain their jobs after they were federalized in 2001. The verdict gave plaintiffs 1 year of what they would have earned had they attained jobs with the Federal Transportation Security Administration, plus $10,000 for pain and suffering. Screeners who found other work within that year received less. The plaintiffs had worked between 2 months and 10 years for a Huntley USA when Congress required that all airport screeners become federal employees. Federal officials promised to give preference to experienced Huntley employees who passed the test but hired new screeners before testing former workers, according to the lawsuit. When Huntley screeners were tested, most jobs were filled, the suit said. 23 plaintiffs passed an initial computer assessment, but 20 failed a second phase that tested physical ability. This from the Oregonian.
The Oregon legislature missed a 1:30 p.m. goal for winding up its special session yesterday, but it was well on the way to a mid-afternoon finish. Shortly before 2:30, the House finished passing all five of the bills being considered by the legislature. These include legislation to increase school and human services funding, triple the minimum prison terms for sexual predators, and limit the rates and fees on short-term loans. At the time the House finished, the Senate was considering the last of the five bills, the one that would increase the minimum penalties for sexual attacks on children. Due to negotiations before the special session, Governor Kulongoski is expected to sign all of the legislation passed yesterday. This from the Oregonian.
Oregon lags below the national average in providing health insurance to poor people, especially children, according to the Oregonian. The findings, which put the state fifth from the bottom in covering children, come on the eve of a special legislative session called, in part, to fill a $136.2 million budget gap at the Department of Human Services. That gap, in turn, is driven largely by a $65 million hole in the Oregon Health Plan budget. Oregon legislators and health officials say they can fill the gap this time without additional cuts, but they also agreed that Oregon's renowned plan for insuring the poor has reached a crossroads between coverage and costs, forcing difficult choices soon, if not this week. The question left to future legislators and perhaps a future governor is how to regain the state's reputation as a health care leader while also keeping a lid on health care spending.
Salem Kaiser teachers ignored the school board's deadline yesterday to accept its limited-time offer of a 4-year contract with salary and insurance increases each year. Instead, during contract negotiations Thursday, the union proposed a 2-year contract that includes larger pay and insurance increases and a per-student bonus for teacher whose classes have more than a set number of students. Under the proposal, teachers would be paid about $250 based on the state per-student funding amount for each student over an ideal class size number that was set by the school board in 1991. For kindergarten through second grade, that number is 25. For third grade, it's 27. And fourth through sixth grades, it's 30. District policy does not set a number for grades 7 through 12, but Costa said the union is aiming for 27. The extra pay also would be given to counselors who carry caseloads of more than 330 students and would apply to other specialists such as library, media specialists, and special education teachers.
Coos Bay County was, until last year, the largest county in the United States without a natural gas service. But it could become a major exporting point if plans are realized to build a liquefied natural gas terminal at Coos Bay and a 36-inch pipeline. That big line would bring gas from ocean-going tankers for distribution eastward to a trunk line running down the flanks of the Cascade Range and then to markets in the west, which are using natural gas at a rapid clip. Just a year ago, Coos County officials opened a smaller 12-inch pipeline to bring natural gas service westward for distribution to homes, businesses, and industries in the area. Whichever way the gas flows, it brings controversy to Coos County. Construction of the smaller line from Roseburg on the Interstate 5 corridor was contentious and featured environmental lawsuits, the firing of one contractor, and not all of which have been resolved. Now, residents have objected to plans for surveys for a route for the bigger pipeline from the proposed liquefied natural gas terminal. The energy company, Williams Northwest Pipelines, has sent 700 letters to residents in Coos, Klamath, Douglas, and Jackson counties, requesting permission to enter their property to the surveys. This from the Coos Bay News Service.
If you want to cast a ballot in the May 16 primary, you must register to vote by Tuesday. County elections offices will accept postcard registrations if they are postmarked by Tuesday. You must re-register if you have changed your name, address, or party affiliation. Only registered Democrats can choose Democratic nominees in a primary under Oregon law, and only registered Republicans can choose Republican nominees. All voters may vote on nonpartisan candidates and ballot measures. New registration cards require voters to list either their Oregon driver's license number or the final four digits of their Social Security number as proof of residency. 2002 federal law imposed the requirement. The law does not require voters to re-register if they have no changes to report. Registered voters may update their registrations after the deadline under certain conditions. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
National Intelligence Director John Negroponte says that nearly 100,000 Americans are working in intelligence in the U.S. and around the world. This is the first time the actual number has been revealed. In a speech at the National Press Club marking his first year on the job, Negroponte indicated his willingness to make some normal classified information public. The government has long protected details about the size and budget of its spy agencies, which include the CIA, National Security Agency, parts of the FBI, and other lesser-known outfits, such as the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and others. But some classified morsels have gotten out. For instance, Mary Margaret Graham, Negroponte's top deputy for intelligence collection, goofed in a speech last fall and said overall U.S. intelligence budget is $44 billion, a number that open government advocates have sued unsuccessfully to get. It's not clear how far Negroponte is willing to go to provide more information to the public. Yesterday, he condemned leaks of classified information, but he also said public understanding is important.
18 anti-war activists who call themselves the Granny Peace Brigade appeared in court yesterday for trial on charges of disorderly conduct stemming from a protest outside a military recruiting station. The defendants, some supporting themselves with canes and walkers, are being tried as a group before Manhattan Criminal Court Judge Neil Ross. If convicted, each could face up to 15 days in prison. Assistant District Attorney Amy Miller said the defendants sat in front of the Times Square recruiting station on October 17th, obstructed pedestrian traffic, and refused to disperse as ordered. Miller said this prevented others from going in or out of the center. Defense Attorney Norman Siegel said that women went to the recruiting station to try to enlist, but the door was locked. So they sat and started chanting, "We insist, we want to enlist." Siegel said the defendants had a right to protest the war in Iraq and to sit in front of the recruiting station. Earlier Thursday, the women rejected a plea deal that would have dismissed the charges in 6 months if the women had no further violations of law. The women vowed to keep up the protests.
President Bush and Chinese President Hu Jintao pledged cooperation in reining in the nuclear ambitions of Iran and North Korea and resolved troubled trade disputes of their own Thursday. But they made little measurable headway in a pomp-filled summit that was infiltrated by a screaming anti-China protester. In a half day of talks, the watchwords were candor and discussion, not agreement and announcement. The discussions touched on American concerns about Beijing's human rights record and the global energy impact of the communist giant's rapidly expanding economy, as well as China's sensitivity over the status of Taiwan. White House officials stressed the growing sophistication of U.S.-Chinese relations and the increased personal familiarity between Bush and Hu after 5 meetings in less than a year as one of the summit's achievements. In opening remarks after a majestic arrival ceremony, Hu made clear he did not intend to do much more than reiterate past promises. Hu had barely begun his speech when a woman began pleading with Bush to stop the Chinese president from persecuting the Falun Gong, a banned religious movement that accuses the Chinese government of torturing and killing its followers.
A Senate measure to fund the war in Iraq would chop money for troops' night vision equipment and new battle vehicles, but add $230 million for a tilt-rotor aircraft that has already cost $18 billion and is still facing safety questions. President Bush's request for the emergency appropriations to cover the costs of continuing war and Hurricane Katrina recovery operations included no money for the troubled V-22 Osprey, which takes off and lands like a helicopter but flies like a plane. Critics maintain that it's still a curious choice to be funded in a bill whose defining purpose is to replace equipment worn out or destroyed in Iraq. The Osprey, manufactured by Bell Helicopter, a subsidiary of Textron Incorporated, has been in development since the 1980s and has cost the government $18 billion so far. It has suffered numerous setbacks over the years, including 2 crashes in 2000 that killed 23 people. To pay for the Ospreys, the Senate Appropriations Committee cut into funding for night vision goggles, equipment for destroying mines and explosives, fire suppression systems for light armored vehicles, and new vehicles that can be transported into battle inside the V-22. The panel insists the equipment cuts won't affect readiness.
U.S. authorities have arrested almost 1,200 people in what they say is the largest raid of its kind on undocumented migrants working in the country. The alleged undocumented immigrants worked for the same crate company and were held in 9 different states. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff said the raid was a warning to workers and employers who tolerate or perpetuate a shadow economy. The U.S. Senate has been deadlocked over plans to reform immigration rules. The Senate is due to resume its debate in a few days. President Bush has proposed the introduction of a guest worker scheme, but this faces stiff opposition from some in his own Republican Party who see it as being too soft on lawbreakers. According to the BBC's Washington correspondent, the latest raid is clearly designed to counter that impression. The target of the raid was IFCO, a German-based company that specializes in the manufacture of crates. 7 officials from the company were among those arrested. This according to the BBC.
In his heyday, Jack Anderson broke the story of the CIA plot to assassinate Fidel Castro. Now, 4 months after his death, the investigative columnist apparently still has some secrets to disclose because the FBI wants to rifle through his archives. Amid a widening crackdown on leaks by the Bush administration, the attempt to investigate a journalist who stopped reporting in 1990 and who has been dead since December caused outrage from civil libertarians and from Anderson's family, which said it would not turn over his records. The FBI maintains that it is unlawful for individuals to possess classified documents and that the material belongs to the government. At the height of his 50-year career, Anderson's Washington merry-go-round column was carried by nearly 1,000 newspapers. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1972 for his reporting on U.S. relations with India and Pakistan, and also made it to the top of Richard Nixon's list of enemies. The records of his career, stored in 188 boxes, are held at George Washington University. The FBI first demanded access to the archives in March. The FBI maintained that it wanted access to the archives to help with the prosecution of 2 lobbyists for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, who go on trial next month on espionage charges.
Thank you.
If not al-Jafari, then who? Shiite politicians in Iraq are divided over who should replace Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari at the top of their new government. They're meeting today to try to pick someone. There are two favorites for the role, and both are members of al-Jafari's Dawa party. But sources say there's a split among the seven parties that make up the Shiite coalition on who the choice should be. The candidate has to be acceptable to Sunnis and Kurdish politicians as well. The Shiites are the biggest bloc in parliament, but lack the strength to govern without Sunni and Kurdish partners. As the biggest bloc, the Shiites get first crack at the prime minister's job.
The African Development Bank, AFDB, on Wednesday approved an $8.5 billion debt relief package for 33 African countries to help fight poverty. The multilateral lender said in a statement the move by its African Development Fund, the arm of the bank that lends to Africa's poorest countries, formed part of help for the continent, agreed at a group of eight nations summit at Glen Eagle, Scotland in 2005. The write-offs are aimed at allowing governments to raise spending on programs that reduce poverty. The package covers countries involved in the Heavily Indebted Poor Countries Initiative, or HIPC, a global debt relief project approved in 1996 that was based on good economic governance. The Tunisia-based AFDB said the 33 countries included 14 that had passed the so-called HIPC completion point, the date when the scheme's debt write-off becomes effective. 13 of the 14 would enjoy immediate benefits, according to Reuters.
Haitians prepared to take the final step in their return to democracy with a legislative runoff today to select the first popularly elected government since a 2004 revolt threw the country into chaos. The race for 127 parliamentary seats features several hundred candidates from more than a dozen parties, ranging from members of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide's centre-left La Valas party to former rebels who helped oust him. Observers say a large turnout would boost President-elect René Préval's legislative agenda to rebuild the Caribbean nation, which has been battered by gang violence, the closure of many textile factories, and high unemployment. Observers say Préval's L'Espoir party is likely to capture the largest number of seats, but will probably fall short of a majority and will have to forge a coalition government. Under Haiti's constitution, the party or coalition with the most parliamentary seats gets to choose the prime minister, who acts as head of government and appoints cabinet members and most administrative posts. Parliament also must ratify all foreign loans, making it vital to Haiti's dealings with the international community.
The Chinese Prime Minister has ordered the country's vast bureaucracy to improve environmental protection, according to The Guardian. The move is a shift away from the government's 25-year policy of economic growth at all costs. The move comes as Beijing experienced some of the foulest pollution in years. Dust storms, exhaust emissions, and grit from building sites have choked the skies, turning the streets yellow and prompting health warnings that children should be kept indoors with the windows closed. In an unusually stinging critique, the premier, Wen Jiabo, said measures to conserve nature and improve air and water quality over the past 5 years had failed, resulting in severe ecological degradation. Environmental protection has become the weakest aspect in social and economic development, the China Daily quoted him as saying. The implementation of green laws is not strict at all. Every 6 months, local government will be obliged to release information on energy consumption, which should be cut by 20% by 2011. The supervisory system is so lax that its targets may not be reached. Last week, the government said it had failed to achieve 8 of its 20 environmental goals.
According to The Guardian, human rights groups have attacked the EU for negotiating a trade deal with Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan is one of the harshest regimes in the former Soviet Union. Campaigners have accused the EU of turning a blind eye to the abuses of President Saparmurat Niyazov as it eyes up his country's huge gas reserves. Last month, influential foreign and trade committees of the parliament voted in favor of the agreement, which will now go to the full parliament. Once passed, it will move on to the Council of Ministers for approval. Critics say the EU is ignoring blatant human rights abuses because it wants European companies to be allowed to grab a share of Turkmenistan's huge gas reserves. Turkmenistan is keen to bypass Russia and Ukraine, which are its main customers. The European Commission, which first proposed establishing an interim agreement on trade and trade-related matters with Turkmenistan in 1998, said it was simply recognizing the country as a sovereign state. The old accord was one that was with the Soviet Union. The new accord, it added, included a human rights clause to allow the EU to pursue human rights concerns with the country, and it did not offer any new trade advantages. This, according to The Guardian.
The nuclear whistleblower and peace activist Mordecai Vanunu has been told that the ban stopping him leaving Israel has been extended for another year and that he is still viewed by the authorities as a security risk to the state. Vanunu said yesterday that he was disappointed by the decision, which he learned about from a letter sent to him from Ehud Olmert, Israel's prime minister-designate, on the eve of the second anniversary of his release from jail. A former technician at Israel's nuclear weapons facility, Vanunu was released from an 18-year prison term 2 years ago today. The official government position is that Vanunu still holds information that affects the country's security. Gideon Spiro, a member of the Israeli campaign that supports him and opposes nuclear weapons in the Middle East, said, "No serious person believes he is a security risk. It is a cynical excuse because security is a sacred cow in Israel. The real reason is that they cannot accept the fact that he came out of prison sane and committed to the same ideals after 18 years. It is pure vendetta." Vanunu faces charges in connection with talking to foreign media. He is due to appear in court on May 1st when a judge will rule on his lawyer's application to have all the charges dismissed.
The government of Nepal has imposed a new shoot-to-kill curfew in Kathmandu in the wake of escalating violence between police and protesters. The curfew, which will remain in force throughout the day, coincides with a planned rally called by the opposition. Police yesterday opened fire on demonstrators who defied the curfew, killing three and wounding many more. The protesters, who have staged mass strikes for the past 2 weeks, want the king to give up direct rule. King Gyanendra dismissed Parliament in February of 2005, saying the government had failed to defeat Nepal's Maoists. The opposition alliance has called for its supporters to demonstrate on Kathmandu's Ring Road today. Yesterday's deaths occurred during a 25-hour shoot-on-site curfew imposed in the city centre to 200 metres around its Ring Road. Sources at the hospital where the dead protesters were taken said police had seized the bodies and brought them to a government hospital. 10 people have been killed elsewhere since the strike began. This from the BBC.
A 7.7 magnitude earthquake hit a distant, sparsely populated region of Russia's Far East on Friday, and there were reports in at least one coastal village of minor injuries and damaged buildings, including schools and a hospital. U.S. Geological Survey and Japan's Meteorological Agency estimated the quake's magnitude at 7.7. There were numerous aftershocks ranging from magnitude 4.5 to 5.4. Koto Sanav told the Associated Press by phone that there were reports of damage in some villages in the Pacific region and that emergency officials were flying by helicopter to several locations. Federal emergency officials in Moscow said they had no information about the quake. Russian news agencies said buildings had been damaged in the coastal village of Tulichiki, including schools, a hospital, and an airport. The agency said there was also some minor injuries in the village, which has a population of about 2,000. Russia's North Pacific coast sits along a major tectonic plate and is frequently hit by earthquakes and volcanic eruptions.
In the sharpest power dispute yet, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas today blocked Hamas's plans to set up a shadow security force which was to be made up of militants and to be headed by the number two on Israel's wanted list. Abbas issued a presidential decree vetoing the decisions made a day earlier by Interior Minister Saeed Siam of Hamas. As president, Abbas wields considerable power and has the right to approve or reject key appointments. Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of Hamas was to meet with his interior minister later today to weigh a response. Siam's decision yesterday to set up the new force and appoint Jamal Abul Samadana as its commander was seen as a major provocation to Abbas, to Israel, and to the international community. Abbas and Hamas have been wrangling over authorities since the Islamic militant group won January parliamentary elections. After the Hamas victory, Abbas took control of the state-run media, the Palestinian Investment Fund, and the authority controlling borders. Hamas has complained it was largely left with paying salaries for some 165,000 government employees, a task it cannot meet because the West has cut off financial aid. This according to the BBC. This has been the KBOO Morning News for Thursday, April 21st, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news, KBOO's volunteer audio engineers edited tape, and KBOO's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and she is on the board right now. I'm Chris Andre.
I'm Jake Wallner.
We welcome your participation in the AM newsroom. Who doesn't want to get up at 3:30 in the morning and come into Portland to write the news? Well, who does want to? You do. Call, volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202. You can reach us by email at amnews@kboo.org or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The KBOO website is www.kboo.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of solid news on KBOO Evening News. Portland area weather today, cloudy, rain this morning, clearing in the afternoon, highs around 60. Tonight, rain, windy in the eastern gorge, temperatures in the 40s.